Hello.
And welcome to We're Not Blowing Hot Air, powered by Oxygen Plus. I'm Scott.
And I'm Lauren.
And we're here to help elevate your IQ on wellness and business stuff that's sometimes misunderstood.
Oh, like recreational oxygen?
Yes.
Let's get smarter with this week's guest of We're Not Blowing Hot Air. We have New Year's Eve just around the corner.
I know.
What are you going to do?
Oh,
any
I don't
idea?
Know. No? No. I feel kind of lame because, you know, in my adult life, I really don't do New Year's Eve like I used to.
Yeah, that is lame.
When I was younger.
Yeah.
It's lame.
Yeah, yeah, never compromise New Year's Eve.
It's always got to be big.
It's got to be big.
Yeah.
I remember seeing fireworks from an airplane one, and I met a guy on that same airplane.
Yeah.
Didn't work out yet. But yes. That was memorable. Most New Year's Eves, though, I don't know if I really remember them all.
Yeah, might be a reason for that. There's definitely a reason I don't remember them all. Some stand out. You know, when I was younger, I would go out with friends. We'd go out to the bar, and it was a thing, you mm-hmm. know? Or somebody just had a bunch of people over to their house, and it was a thing.
You could probably do one of those with your kids.
Yeah.
Maybe both.
Yeah. Yeah, we probably could.
Maybe this year's the year, Scott.
Maybe.
Well, you know, when did liquor become kind of more serious for you? Was there a moment or a certain person or even liquor itself that kind of changed how it became less of a party tool?
Yeah.
And more something that was maybe more mature, part of your everyday life.
Yeah. Interesting question. Yeah. So sometime in my late 20s, I would call it, I had a friend that started like home brewing his own beer, and I would try it, and I would, you know, I got exposed to like these different types of like craft beers.
Mm-hmm. Did this guy have a beard?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. I was just stereotyping
yes.
there. Go ahead.
Yes. He yeah. was a bearded beer brewer.
Right.
And, so I got exposed to like craft beers and uh-huh. some different stuff, and I started to like it. So I started to kind of branch out and try different things. And then later on, I was introduced to whiskey by a member of my wife's extended family.
Mm.
And, that was kind
like,
of
so your
thing.
Family.
Essentially my family.
You're not quite owning yeah. that side yet.
No. No.
Okay, so whiskey, yeah. And yeah. what kind of whiskey?
At the time, it was scotch.
Mm-hmm.
But I've become a bourbon guy now.
All right.
Bourbon's kind of my thing. I still, you know, reach for the scotch every once in a while.
Well, me too. Me too. And I yeah. got to scotch whiskey
yeah.
because my grandpa, well, we're Scottish on that side of the family. The side of the family I own. and he is Scottish, where that lineage is Scottish. And he would drink Dewars, so he would have some American whiskey as well.
Mm-hmm.
But predominantly I like the Scotch aspect of it because it was dually something that I identified with my grandpa. And I had to drink it, and I had to drink better whiskey to acquire the taste. It didn't mm-hmm. happen right away. So I remember I was living in Chicago at the time, and I would, you know, order it and like grimace and wince and just, but eventually my taste buds turned around.
Yeah.
And I caught up.
You mentioned like drinking better ones.
Mm-hmm.
I think that for me personally, that's been true for scotch.
Yeah.
If you drink like a cheap budget scotch, for me, it didn't work.
No.
If I was at like the $50 a bottle and up, then I was like, okay, I can drink this. It sounds really snooty,
yeah, no.
but
no. I did a blind taste test. I was in Scotland in the Moray Shire area, and which is where I think Glenlivet is we were at that distillery.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
And I asked them for a blind taste test. I did the, is it 11? Is that what the first one normally is? 11, 15?
12, I think.
12. Okay.
I think it's 12.
I did a 12, 15. 18, 21, whatever. I did
that
like
sounds right.
three
yeah.
or four.
Mm-hmm.
And I, with blind taste tests, they're my witness, I picked the higher, more aged
did you?
Ones.
Yeah. Yeah. yeah.
So
interesting that you and I kind of found the same thing there with scotch. I think, mm-hmm. yeah, the better the scotch or the higher quality, the higher the age, higher the price point. It is better, I think. Bourbon's not exactly the same from what I've found. Like, you can find a really good bottle of bourbon, a pretty decent sipper, for like $30 a bottle.
Interesting. I bet it has something to do with the wood in the barrels where they age.
It might, yes.
And maybe they're reused woods from the barrel.
Bourbon actually has to be brand new barrel.
It does.
Brand new barrel.
Well, then this is blowing my mind.
Scotch is made in used barrels, I think. We'll have to fact check this, but I'm pretty sure that's...
Or, you know what? We have an amazing guest coming up.
True. He can answer this for us.
He's an expert in wine and whiskey.
Mm-hmm.
He makes it. He grows it. He drinks it.
Yeah. So he lives it.
I think...
He lives it.
I think, why don't we just stop this random chit-chatting, pour ourselves a glass, and get John Taylor on.
Sounds like a good idea to me.
Best one yet.
Yeah.
All right. Cheers. On episode 10 of We're Not Blowing Hot Air, we crack open bottles of amazing facts about wine and whiskey with John Taylor. John is the official winemaker and distiller of Chancasca Creek Ranch Winery and Distillery, located in Kasota, Minnesota. Revealing the magic and mystery of how wine and whiskey is made, John opens our eyes to the science and art of wine and spirit production, from the month they harvest to the moment you cheers. Plus, John delights us with the chemical role oxygen plays in making wine and whiskey taste so good. All this and more about how to make and drink booze like you mean it on this episode of We're Not Blowing Hot Air.
John Taylor, welcome to the podcast.
Welcome, John.
Well, thanks for having me. Love being here.
Yeah. So, John, you are Vice President of Alcohol Operations and the official winemaker and distiller for Chancasca Creek Ranch Winery and Distillery, located here in Minnesota. That sounds like a pretty awesome job, I got to be honest.
it's something I've been working my whole career towards, and second year here in the big chair, as they like to say. But next year will be my 20th year making wine. Hard to believe.
Wow.
You're too young. Were you starting in the cradle?
Right at 21. Yeah. That's basically the cradle as far as winemaking goes.
Yeah.
Wow. Cool. So you've been doing it a long time. Well, let's talk a little bit about that as far as winemaking. What is a winemaker and what is a distiller?
So a winemaker is an individual who takes grapes and makes a alcoholic beverage. And so how do you do that? Well, you got to go through a fermentation process. You need to extract sugar and liquid out of the grape and then turn that into basically water and alcohol. And there's some other substrates in there as well, acid, tannins, and that sort of thing. But the primary job of a winemaker is mainly a taster, which means for about 6 weeks every year, I am in a vineyard every single day evaluating when those grapes are ready to be harvested. And we do that by tasting. We do that by pulling samples and running chemical metrics on them. And when the ultimate pick point is reached, it's my job to work with the grower then to get those grapes into the winery. And then we start the winemaking process from there.
Okay.
A distiller is someone who takes an alcohol base and then evaporates the alcohol off. Alcohol evaporates at 78.2 degrees Celsius. And so we go through a process in our pot still where we heat that alcohol medium up. And we boil the alcohol out. We evaporate it out of the liquid that it's trapped in. And then we have to redistill it through a second pass.
Okay. So it sounds like two very different processes.
They are.
Right.
They are.
One's more like a farmer, like you're in the field with the grapes, farming and harvesting. And the other is more like a science. You're in a lab coat with some serious glasses on your face, doing charts and analysis. But they both have art and science to it. Do they not? Like,
they are both a science and an art. Mm-hmm. And as I like to say, winemaking is a three-legged stool. It's one part art, one part science, and one part practicality, which more often than not is, can I afford to do what I actually really want to do? At the end of the day, this is still a business. And even though we have three distinct product streams, each one needs to stand on their own and get a margin out of it at the end of the day.
Well, I want to go more into how it's a business and particularly what you're in charge of as VP of alcohol operations, which again is Scott and I are both in operations, but we don't have alcohol in our job titles. So we're just going to drink here today anyways with you. If you have a glass to raise, but how did you first become a winemaker? I mean, can you share that story? And might as well share the distillery story, how you became a distiller as well.
Sure. Yeah. So for my 21st birthday, I grew up in California and I went to Napa Valley for my 21st birthday.
Who'd you go with?
I went with it was three generations. So I went with my parents and then my mother's parents.
That's cool.
My grandmother was a huge food and wine. You know, she was a foodie before foodies became popular.
Cool.
Gourmet cook. I mean, the whole nine. Grew up on a farm in California, that sort of thing. And let's see, her great grandfather made wine in his basement in San Francisco. And we're talking late 1800s. So winemaking's in the blood.
Yeah.
And then my grandfather loved trains. And so we actually did the wine train in Napa Valley as part of this trip. And so we spent 3 days in Napa. And it wasn't until the night before we were about to leave, we were just having a kind of a charcuterie dinner after having been on the wine train during the day for lunch. So kind of a lighter dinner. And my father had brought along a bottle of Beringer Reserve Cabernet that was from a prior trip that he had been on about 6-7 years earlier. And we popped that and I couldn't believe how different it was. The matrix that we were drinking was so completely different than all of the younger wines that we'd been drinking during the trip. And so I was innately curious in college at the time and hadn't really settled on a career on what I wanted to do. And so I went back to college and took a course in organic chemistry and fell in love with wine chemistry essentially at that point and said, this is what I'm going to do with my life. I'm going to make wine for the rest of my life. As far as my working career goes.
Awesome.
Yeah, cool. So started internships and worked my way up the ranks. This Chancasca is my 7th winery that I've worked for in my nearly 20-year career. And you start doing the math, you know, that's not many vintages in each position. And that's not uncommon in this industry. In the first 7 to 10 years of your career, you really are in information gathering mode. You're looking to develop skills, both technical as well as human capital skills. And at the end of the day, you want to craft how you are going to craft wines. And so the way you do that is by exposing yourself to as many individuals as you possibly can.
And right. So you got to like people, I guess, to be a winemaker.
The alcohol business is a people business, and a lot of winery owners may not necessarily be people.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds a little weird, people.
Yeah.
But they're
wine people. They're not
they're
people.
Wine people. People. Yeah. And they often make their money in a different career, whether it's, you know, investment banking or they may be a, you know, sports celebrity at some point, or a doctor or a lawyer, and you would think that those people would understand people, but most people if you're a doctor or a lawyer, you're going to see somebody in a moment of vulnerability, whereas in the wine industry you're seeing somebody who's getting enjoyment out of something that you're making. And so it's a different relationship, it's a different interaction. And for some people, it's hard for them to wrap their head around, how do I entice people to buy my product versus someone else's product? And that doesn't necessarily always equate. And so it's the job of professionals to help ownership understand what those challenges are. And that's one of the unwritten job descriptions that I have.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, you already said that it was a business that required a lot. The third leg to the stool, what was that again?
Practicality. Well, that's the third rule, the business element. The first two are art and science.
Mm-hmm.
And so at the beginning of all of this, everyone has a romance about winemaking. And then towards the middle, they understand that you have to make sound wine, and that's where the science part comes into it. How do I make what I want to make? And we know more about the science of winemaking and distillation than we've ever known in the history of our species. And so we can take all of those learnings that we've gained through the study of these products and apply them to how we're making our product. And we do that, but you have to know what tool to use when. You can't just open the toolbox, start picking tools, and start applying them, because you may not end up with a palatable product at the end of the day. And that's where the experience factor comes in.
Right. Yeah. You learn that process as you go, and what types of tools are best and when. Yeah, that makes sense. Well, how did you get, I mean, you talked about how you kind of fell in love with or determined that you were going to be a winemaker. How about a distiller? How did you get interested in that and decided to do that as well?
Did you get sick of wine?
Yeah. You're all wined out.
Never sick of wine. No, okay, never sick of wine. You get to a point in your career and you start to look at some of the choices you've made. And one of the things that my wife and I were looking at was, we're native Californians. You know, I'm a fifth generation Californian, which is saying something in California. There's not, it's a pretty new European settlement, so to say, relative to the East Coast or the Midwest even. And we were kind of tired of the rat race that became California and trying to survive as far as economics and family economics. And so we started looking at other places to go, and we looked at Washington and Oregon and Texas and Nebraska, and finally ended up in Minnesota. And I got to do two things here that I'd never done in my career, which was make sparkling wines. I'd never been able to do that, and we do that here. And then also the distillation aspect of it. I'd done distilling in college, but I'd never done it commercially. And so before I was the official winemaker and distiller here, I was the assistant winemaker, and my predecessor essentially turned the keys over to me after 2 years and said, okay, I'm going to go retire over here. You have fun. And so for 2 years, I got the ability to mentor, be a mentee under his mentorship, and really learned a lot about the distillation aspect of things. I knew the business aspect. I'd known the, you know, how to make wine, how to have clean fermentations and that sort of thing. And at this point, it was more about applying them appropriately. Again, knowing when to use what tool in what situation.
Are we gonna just pour a little whiskey?
Should we do that?
I've already had a few sips of mine. So
what do you recommend? I have a Buffalo Trace Kentucky straight bourbon whiskey. I have a Bullet Bourbon Frontier whiskey, and I have a Russell's Reserve single barrel non-chilled filtered straight bourbon whiskey.
Well, you can't go wrong with Buffalo Trace, but the Russell single barrel family reserve is probably going to knock your socks off.
Yeah.
I'm doing that one. Yeah. Then.
It is a little higher proof.
Just for the just listeners.
A little higher proof.
This is the bottle Scott brought in, and it's almost empty. So
that's how good it
that's
is.
How.
And I would hazard a guess that's not the first bottle this year that has gone that way.
Oh, wow.
Correct.
Okay. I'm going to pour a little bit. Is it bad taste to put it in my coffee? Or could I just try to
I wouldn't put that one in your coffee.
I would try that one straight. You sure you haven't had anything? Sounds like you're pulling a china shop a little bit there.
Ah, thank you. Love being told that. You know, it went down smooth for me, so I'm a big kid.
I think I poured the Buffalo Trace.
I liked it. I mean, my eyes are watering, but I didn't grimace.
That's good.
Yeah.
You handled it like a pro.
Well, John, who is drinking at your winery right now? What are your customers like?
Our customers are predominantly, I would say, late 20s to early 70s and anywhere in between.
So you don't serve to under 18?
No, not under 21. Yeah, legal is definitely a major factor. And we also have a craft cocktail room as well. So a way for us to showcase our spirits was to add on to our tasting room and create a craft cocktail lounge. And so we have a cocktail or two on every spirit that we make here in the distillery as well.
And you can rent like party room, like can you do an event, bachelor party, that kind of deal?
Yeah, absolutely. We have our barrel room, which I know you were able to be in.
Guilty.
As a party. The barrel room is definitely rentable. We have a 350 person event center that's rentable that has a full bar in it. We have a tent during the warmer months here in Minnesota, and so that's rentable. That's about 250 people. And then we have three other venues throughout the grounds that have power to them and are great wedding ceremony sites, but we've had a number of people rent them for like family reunions and that sort of thing as well. So lots of rentable space here at the winery. We've even rented the cocktail lounge out itself to different groups. So
it's about being connected and available and involved and engaged with what is here. And that includes you, right?
That's a big part of it is
people,
being connected. You know, the product is the lubrication of good conversation typically. And we want people to be relaxed and enjoying themselves, and we're tickled that they value us enough to be a part of that conversation and of that event.
And I don't know if you can share this, but you also have some quite notable corporate accounts. Are you able to share anything about that, or is that
sure? Yeah, it's common knowledge. We're the official wine and spirit sponsor of Minnesota Wild. We are the official wine of Golden Gopher Athletics at the University of Minnesota. We're the official wine and spirit of Mankato State University hockey. We have a program with the MSU Mankato men's basketball team where we did a private label for them, and a portion of the proceeds from those wines go to support the basketball program. We in the past have been the sponsor at the Minnesota Timberwolves and did a private label series of three wines for them. So we've been very active in the corporate space, and we've been approached by others. And if the deal is right and it works for both parties, then it's something that we're worth considering, and we go that direction.
Cool.
Very commendable. Yeah. Well done. I mean, truly talking about the business side of it.
Me being kind of a bourbon guy, what about the different varieties of the spirits, you know, the whiskeys that you like, the distilling that you guys are doing? How do you get those different varieties? What do you guys do in your process?
Yeah, spirits making is more regulated, believe it or not, than wine. And wine has a series of rules behind it on what you can do and what you can put on the label, et cetera, et cetera. But when it comes to spirits, it's highly regulated in what things are called and what they are sourced out of. So a little bit about, you know, we're going to go back, I'll rewind it a little bit. So in order to get fermentable sugars to make distilled spirits, you have to take a grain, extract the starch, and convert that starch then into a fermentable sugar. And so the question is, what is that base grain that you're going to be making? In Scotland, when they make scotch, that's going to be barley, two-row barley. Same product that ends up making most beer today. And I'm not talking the big guys, the big behemoths that make light beer. They've got a whole bunch of other adjuncts. But when you talked about craft brewery, they're going to be using pretty close to 100% barley in their mash that they then cook to extract those sugars in order to ferment and make beer out of. That's essentially the same thing that we're doing with distilled spirits, is we are mashing grains, whether they be corn, rye, wheat, or barley, and then fermenting that to dryness so that there's no more sugar left. And then we take that liquor and distill it in our still. So we separate the alcohol from the solids and the other non-alcoholic components. We then have to redistill that and take our heads, tails, and hearts. And then those hearts are actually what end up going into a barrel as far as whiskey goes in order to make spirits. If we're making gin, those hearts are going to be infused with botanicals, different aromatic compounds that will be extracted during the distillation, and that will become gin. If you're making vodka, it's going to be clean hearts from the middle of the run. And so when it comes to brown spirits, it's highly regulated typically on how long and in what you have to age that product in order to legally be labeled bourbon. You have to be 51% corn in your mash. You have to spend a minimum of 2 years in a brand new American oak charred barrel. And that's actually codified in the law. So the regulations that the United States have on what is legally declared bourbon, you know what the rules are. You have to play by those rules or you will lose your bond. You'll lose your license to produce. And then,
so for the record, Scott, earlier we were talking about what bourbon is, and you were right.
I was right.
Two years, though. Did you know that? I knew
yep. there was a minimum. I didn't know what it was. Okay. I probably would have guessed four, but I was fairly certain that it had to be a new barrel that to be called bourbon. It had to be done in a new barrel.
Well done. I'm going to cheers you to that, Scott.
Thank you. Cheers.
Yeah. And then rye would be kind of the opposite, same rules, but so the age requirement and the oak, but the only difference being 51% rye grains at that point.
Okay.
So bourbon, 51% corn, rye is 51% rye.
Yep.
And then the rest can be whatever.
It can be a number of different adjuncts. And then in order to be called single malt, it needs to be barley from all one source.
Barley from one source. Okay. So you could have multiple sources
for something. Yeah, so like if you're making bourbon or you're making rye, you don't have to be solely sourced from a single place.
You mean region? It's like a region.
Region or farm, yeah.
And year as well. What about year? Can I take a 2021 with 22?
Doesn't matter. Okay. Doesn't matter. Okay. The age requirements is starts the minute that you fill that new barrel or barrel period. Like with brandy, you have to do 2 years of age, but it doesn't have to be in a new barrel, and it can be whatever barrel you want. It doesn't have to be American oak. So brandy's got a lot more flexibility in terms of what you can age it in and how long you have to age it. Well, you have to age it for 2 years, but what you age it in is, and what you blend into it is far more loose as far as the government goes.
Okay. So would you say that it's easier, quote unquote, to do brandy or something like that as opposed to a bourbon that just has a lot more like requirement around it?
I think the spirits in general are just harder because you've got so much time involved that you don't know what you have until you get to that point in time that you start sampling and trying to put a product together. And so the art and the practicality of big distillation distilleries, the consistency that they have year in and year out with their product lines is just mind blowing to me, because there's so many variables at work. I mean, each individual barrel in itself is a different element than the barrel next to it. Barrels may have been made and fired in the exact same, right next to one another in the cooperage, and filled with the exact same product in the distillery, and they could be completely different spirits.
Mm. Yeah, that's incredible. And I think I heard somewhere too that sometimes those different barrels of different ages are mixed with each other to become the final product. Am I right about that?
You are absolutely right about that.
And okay.
So if there is a age listed on the label, that is the youngest age that make up that particular bottling.
Got it. So if you have a 12-year-old scotch or something, there could be a 20-year-old something from
age.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yep.
So a barrel that's been sitting there for 30 to maybe 50 years, and that's being used to mix with younger barrels to ultimately get what ends up in the bottle.
Yeah, that's the secret to consistency. Wow. When it comes to distillation, is by having that older product, you can then mellow the younger product by adding that older product back to it.
That's incredible.
As I say, the art and the science and the practicality, they all have to come together at the end of the day.
John, would you share with us what the Angel Share is?
Absolutely. The Angel Share is an evaporation of alcohol. And that happens to anything aged in a wood environment. So I was going to say oak, but there are other woods besides oak that barrels are made out of as well. And so over time, the wood will actually absorb some of that liquid, and it will decrease the amount of volume in the barrel. And in the terms of distilleries, that alcohol will actually then evaporate. Because we're going into a barrel at higher than 100 proof, and that would be about 50% alcohol to the layperson, the alcohol is highly volatile above 100 proof. And so it will evaporate into thin air unless you have it covered and contained and sealed. And so over time, the barrel actually emits that alcohol. It goes through the barrel, from inside the barrel, goes through the wood, and it evaporates into the air. So you walk into these barrel storage warehouses in bourbon country, and you walk in and you can smell the bourbon in the air, because that's the Angel Share.
It's lovely. It's very, I think, beautiful and poetic. It's also a real, I mean, it ends up being on a spreadsheet somewhere, right? In your operations, because it's actually a loss that you, 15 years is maybe, I don't know, what's an average
loss? Before? Average loss is somewhere between 2-4% a year.
Wow.
Okay. Of volume.
So that's notable. I mean, in the sense of like, you have to account for that, like in some amortization schedule or something.
Well, Scott, what's the cost of a good bottle of bourbon, right?
Yeah.
He said 50 earlier. Is that right, John?
You get into 50 or 60
$50 to $60 yeah.
For a bottle of good bourbon. That's some of that Angel Share that's put into that. It's not just marketing. There's actual real, the amount of liquid that you start with and the amount of distilled product is about 15% of what the original start volume is.
Okay.
So if you've got 100,000 gallons of, or let's do simple math, 150,000 gallons worth of distilled spirit, that means you had 1 million gallons to start that process.
So this takes space. You need like an operation set up. Anything else you want to share about kind of like the business side of how whiskey and wine gets from harvest to the glass, how it gets produced?
You know, the big part about the alcohol business is that if the consumer does not know who you are, they're not going to go searching for you. So a big part of the alcohol industry is actually brand awareness, marketing, advertising, attracting people to your product. And whether that's, you know, through events or third parties or using the established trade and media to expose people to your product and how good that product, that's really why wine ratings exist. Spirit ratings exist, is to expose a larger segment of your target market to your products. A fair amount of what a winery or distillery does is marketing. Wild Turkey right now, the Russell family, has Matthew McConaughey as their spokesperson. And so a massive part of that is, again, mixing and matching and marrying your desired target market with your product. And so you look for opportunities to leverage not just popular culture, but just environment and sense of place, that terroir again. How do you maximize all of that and get to the point where you've got the right person in the right place in front of the right product?
Yeah, you've got to, I mean, there are a lot of distillers out there. There's a lot of brewers, a lot of winemakers. So yeah, you got to set yourself aside. So not only do you have to hone your craft and make a seriously good product, you know, the best product that you can make, but then have a serious like marketing strategy and try to get in front of people as much as you can. It's got to be challenging.
It is very challenging. And one of the things that I like to say is winemaking, spirits making is 50% sanitation, cleaning, 25% actually making product, and 25% other. And that other can be anything from necessary paperwork for the government to make sure that they're happy with what you're doing, to marketing, to sales calls, to lab work here in the lab, and email correspondence, keeping up with distribution, keeping up with sales, keeping up with all of those different elements that is not necessarily making the product or necessarily improving it. But at the end of the day, again, it's a business and you need to put your product in front of the right consumers so that they can enjoy it. I tell my assistant winemaker and my enologist all the time, you guys have the best jobs in the company because you get the least amount of other work and the most amount of product making work. And I get the lion's share of the marketing and face of the brand and opportunities like that, and dealing with the business end of things as far as production goes. I don't get to make product a whole lot on the floor physically day in and day out. Now I taste everything. Just the other day we went through 42 barrels of Marquette to make sure that they all made the cut and ended up in a bottled product. And so literally every single barrel had to be tasted, and there were four that were above and beyond what I thought the rest of the lot were, and we set those aside to do something with later.
A reserve or something like that?
A reserve or a blending opportunity for something else, something that I deemed maybe had more potential than just being bottled up and sold as Minnesota Marquette.
All right. Well, we might be having an Oxygen Plus holiday party, so keep that in mind.
Hey,
we might go down to the barrel room.
Yeah. There we go.
By the way, I do hope people who are local in Minnesota or even from surrounding states or California come check it out, because it's phenomenal. You're phenomenal. I'd like to get more into the nerdy side of you, John.
Sure.
You had mentioned how oxygen plays a role in some of the production of whiskey and wine. Can we go there?
Absolutely, we can go there. Okay. You know, we've kind of already been teasing this a little bit. Oxygen management is so necessary during the fermentation process. A lot of people are familiar with fermentation because eat sauerkraut, that's a fermented food. Eat yogurt, that's a fermented food. Eat cheese, that's fermented to some degree. And of course, wine and spirits and beer are all fermented products as well. And so the yeast need oxygen as part of a healthy fermentation. So how do you do that? Well, you have to introduce it in various forms. You can bubble it directly into the fermentation. You can add it via a Venturi process, or you can screen it through a screen into a tub and then pump it back into the tank. And so those are all various forms of, in which you can introduce oxygen into a fermentation. With our spirits, since we're fermenting on the grains themselves, we have an agitator running. And so it creates a whirlpool, and you will get aeration into the fermentation of the mash that way. And then afterwards, once you're done with the winemaking process, once you're done with the distillation process, and you have put your product into a barrel, you're now adding oxygen to in small amounts into the barrel. Every time you open the top of the barrel for wine to either top the barrel up or to grab a sample from it, you're actually introducing oxygen into the media at that point. With spirits, typically we use hard wooden bungs. We hammer them in place, and then we let them sit for years. And so you've got that angel share and slow amounts of oxygen going back into that spirit, helping mellow those tannins and that alcohol and marry that product together. So you've got oxygen at various different points. Now, once you get wines finished, oxygen becomes your enemy. You don't want a lot of oxygen contact with the wine. And so you have to use inert gas blankets. You have to maximize your oolage, or minimize your oolage, I should say, which is the amount of headspace in your tanks. So right-sizing your productions for the right volume that you're going to be producing. And so these are all production factors that come into play. And again, oxygen management is one of those tools I was talking about. So the oxygen can be a hindrance, but it can also be a huge help. And so knowing when to use oxygen and how much to use is a critical part of what a winemaker or a distiller does, because it is such an integral part of the process of making alcoholic spirits or wines.
Is the oxygen you're using ambient air? I mean, is that what you're saying? You're just managing the existing air, which is it filtered in the distillery or the wine? What do you call it? Where you make the wine? Is that
In the winery? In
winery.
The cellar. The cellar is a uniform term, both in the winery and into the distillery business.
So what's the air like there?
We use ambient air. So our ambient air, because we're in Minnesota, our winery is indoors. It's completely climate controlled. We do have filters. We have air filters throughout the building to keep the amount of dust, particularly That was a good little pun there, John. I didn't even mean to do that. But to keep dust and other particles to a minimum. And right. So we don't necessarily use medical or food grade oxygen unless there's an application that calls for it. One of the tools is a process called microoxygenation. And what you can do is, instead of utilizing individual barrels, you can add toasted wood, just like you would get in a barrel, but you can add it directly to a tank. And then you can put a sparging stone in and use a computer program and a device to meter in small amounts of food grade oxygen to mimic the amount of oxygenation that you would get through barrel aging. So you can soften the wines, integrate those tannins, and develop more complexity and further flavor.
So it speeds up the process.
It speeds it up. It's also a way to do much larger volumes. A single barrel is 59 or 60 gallons. They make bigger barrels, but the bigger the barrel, the less impactful that barrel will be. So the ideal thing, if you want a lot of barrel impact, is to actually use these barrel alternatives, these wood products that are treated just like a barrel would be, but you then use it in conjunction with micro oxygenation. And so you can do much larger volumes of wine instead of buying a bunch of barrels. Barrels themselves are pretty cost prohibitive, whereas the barrel adjuncts, barrel alternatives, they are significantly cheaper on a per gallon basis.
Okay. So there are like kind of some technology hacks, so to speak, that you can use to
innovations, speed up the process. I think they would prefer you use.
That's probably better. That's probably better. Yeah.
Technology.
That's interesting, because I think, like, for me, again, when I visualize a wine cellar, it's just a bunch of barrels stacked up, you know, sitting there, and probably is for most cases. And I wouldn't immediately think that there's a lot of technology involved, but I mean, you're kind of cluing us into the fact that there could be.
Yeah, there's a significant amount of technology now in both wine and distillation. Our still has more knobs and dials and electronic sensors on it than what most people would associate with a distillation. You walk into a brewery nowadays and it's all automated. It's all air actuated valves. It's all driven by a point of control that's a computer program. The brewers themselves are not adding necessarily grain directly to a tank. It's all hard piped, and the barley will come in massive trucks and will get pumped into big silos, and the breweries or the distilleries will use those silos to then fill their mash tuns. They often have their own grist mills, and so they'll do their own grind on the grains to get to the right grist texture in order to go through their mash process. So the amount of technology now in alcohol production is significant. We still have a fair amount of small operations that are doing it, very old school, and sometimes the old ways are the best ways. The more intervention you have, the more intervention you will continue to have to do. And so the less intervention you have to do, the less you will have to do as a whole, typically. And so finding the right tool for the right time, it's a big experience part, but there's also a philosophical part to that as well.
All right. Yeah. You got to love it. You got to give, you have to have patience, right? Love it enough to really take time with whatever technology or old school art craft it is.
Patience is a extremely undervalued virtue in our society today. Mm-hmm. And patience is absolutely necessary in order to make quality alcoholic products. We're talking with spirits upwards of 5 to 15 years, maybe 30 years worth of aging for a particular product. That's an innate amount of patience right there built into the process. With wine, it's kind of the same thing. It's just on a much shorter time frame, but you still have to be patient. You cannot be in a hurry. When you're waiting for a crop to come in and it's sitting there on the vine, and you got the grower looking at his berries starting to shrivel, and he's seeing dollar signs missing because you're waiting for flavor or chemistry to come around. It's a real part of the people business of having to explain what you're trying to do and why you're trying to do it.
It like makes me think we should never be irritated when a bartender doesn't deliver a drink quick enough, right? Yeah. Like, considering
cocktails are a real thing, I gotta tell you.
But John, how can we appreciate when we're drinking a glass of wine or a glass or a shot of whiskey more? Like, what's the way to drink, given all that it took to get into our glass?
Well, typically the price point's going to matter a lot to most people. When you're drinking a less expensive product, there's typically less time spent with that product because it's all about in the moment, being at that point, whatever that product is being served with, whether it's an event or a gathering, it's more about the event or the gathering than it is about the product. Mm-hmm. Most people, when they spend for a more spendy bottle, are going to spend more time with the product because they've spent more of their money on that product. And so they're going to take the time to appropriately enjoy that product.
So how do we drink whiskey? We have a glass here. How do we actually do this? I mean, or wine. I mean, people who smell it, it's just so it's not rancid, right? You're supposed to smell it to make sure it's not rancid. Is that right?
Well, looking for flaws is definitely a part of the olfactory part of the evaluation. So typically when I evaluate any product, I immediately smell it without aerating the product. I literally just smell the product once it's been poured into the glass. I'm looking for, is there anything off about it? So there's a series of different flaws that can be there in either spirits or wine. And then I will aerate the liquid and that will release more aromas.
How do you do that?
So with a wine glass, typically there's going to be a stem and you're just going to swirl the glass, the liquid inside, and give it about two or three times around. And then while it's still moving, I'll actually smell it. Put your nose right into the glass. You really want to get it in there because what that will do is your face will actually trap those aromas and force them to be concentrated while your nose is in the glass.
Like a plug. You're plugging it up in there.
Kind of, yeah. It's almost like a lid. Your face is almost like a lid on that glass.
I know you were talking about wine, but I just did it here with the bourbon.
Got to be careful with the spirits.
So I did it. I smelled it before doing that, and then I swirled it and I smelled it, and it was totally different.
It does. Aeration matters, and so again, that's that interaction of oxygen and releasement of those volatile compounds.
John, one time I had a really bad glass of red wine and I sprayed some of our Oxygen Plus in it, our skinny. I just sprayed the oxygen straight in and it made it a little better. Do you think that's true? Or was it just?
Absolutely. Okay. So, you know, one of the things about oxygen management, again, oxygen management does not just stop once it goes into the bottle. And we do oxygen management putting wines or spirits into the bottle as well. We can vacuum fill them and cork them when we're corking. So we eliminate a fair amount of oxygen and air in the bottle, put it under a small vacuum. We can add screw caps and hit it with inert gas right before we put that screw cap on. And then one of the things in enjoyment, particularly with older wines, this is really popular, it's called decanting, where you literally put the liquid into a vessel that's not the bottle. And typically you're going to be leaving sediment behind in an old wine. So that's one of the reasons to decant. But the other reason is to actually get oxygen into that wine. Again, releasing those aromas and also changing that wine. One of the best things anyone can do to understand the relationship of oxygen in alcoholic products is to take a 10, 15, or a 20-year bottle of red wine that's meant to be aged, decant it and taste that wine and take notes every 10 minutes.
Oh.
And you will see the wine evolve over. It could be an hour. It could be half an hour. It could be 3 hours where that wine completely changes during that time frame.
Can we do that with you one time? Like, just get a really good bottle of wine. Scott will pop by, and then we just drink for that one bottle for 3 hours, John.
That would be a lot of fun.
Okay, yes,
that would be a lot of fun.
I would be,
but those are all various things. And again, oxygen management is integral in alcoholic products because it's so involved in the primary fermentation, in the aging of the product, in the elimination of oxygen during the finishing stages. And then once again, in the enjoyment of the wine, how oxygen plays. There's so many different elements at work, and it takes time to understand how they all play together.
Yeah, interesting. How do you develop your palate in order to be able to taste? Like, you taste the grapes, and you're tasting wine out of each barrel you're talking about to make sure that it's good. How do you know what to look for? How do you develop your palate to be able to taste certain things, when it's good, when it's not?
Are you familiar with Malcolm Gladwell?
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. He's an author that wrote the book Outliers.
And Blink.
Blink, well, right,
and
yeah.
The more famous one.
Yeah, I've heard of Outliers. He's got a series of them.
Anyways, the idea behind Outliers was that it takes 10,000 hours to become proficient in a given skill. And he brought up a number of different examples. The Beatles, his mother, who was the other one? NHL players, they have a tendency to all be born in January, February, or March, because they tend to be a little bit bigger and a little bit stronger than the other kids born later in the year. Well, they realize that the start date of being in a calendar year, those kids have 9 months of advancement on kids born at the later half of the year. And so the distribution chart of when their birthdays were was skewed towards January to March. Mm-hmm. Same thing happens in doing alcohol, making alcohol for a living. It's about 12 years of 3 month harvests to become proficient at 10,000 hours. You're going to put about 10,000 hours in during a 3 month harvest over about 12 years.
So nobody if Scott and I are at like a business dinner or something, and somebody's like, oh, Brinkins this year, this vintage, and then they smell it and they're like, oh, that's this. Like, they're full of crap because it would have taken them 10,000 hours to really know what a note is.
So where I was going with that is you have to expose yourself to as many different things. So we were talking about cigars and how walking into a humidor is unlike any other aromatic experience. Well, you have to experience that in order to have that experience to be able to apply that if you smell that smell again. Gary Vaynerchuk.
A reference point.
Sure. Smell is your strongest memory, period.
Yeah.
The memories that are tied to smell are so powerful compared to any other memories that you generate. Gary Vaynerchuk is famous. He was the wine library guy, and now he runs a big social media marketing firm. And he was famous for doing YouTube videos. He did 1,000 YouTube videos on wine reviews. And he did a whole video on how to taste wine. And he literally had a wet rock and was licking it in this YouTube video. He goes, now I know what wet slate tastes like because I literally just tasted it on my tongue. And, you know, what does wet earth taste like? Mm. What does moss taste like? If you're not smelling them, if you're not tasting them, you are not exposed to what they actually are. And until you create those reference points and you can recall them in an instant in the glass, that's the part that takes time to develop. So the moral of the story is, the more you taste, the more experiences you have when it comes to sensory evaluation, the better you'll get at it.
And the more you're plugged into your world and your life and mm-hmm. like what's all around you. Yeah. Like, just try eating some dirt. Right? Like, that's not a joke. Right?
He actually did that on the Ellen Show.
Right.
And the Conan O'Brien Show. He did wine tasting for dummies and brought all these sensory things. And literally Ellen's like eating dirt on her television show.
So it's not about aspiring or trying to achieve some sort of wine status, some vinophile level. It's more about like getting real with like what's around you. How do you experience the world? I like that, John. That makes it like an even playing field for Scott and I.
At the end of the day, that's all we are. We're a sum of our experiences. And your palate and Scott's palate are completely different from my palate. And your palates are probably not the same either. And so just because I say it tastes like something, you could be looking at me going, I don't taste that at all, but it tastes like this to me. And I may not taste that, but again, everyone's palate and everyone's experiences are so different. And
John, do you remember what your, was it a Merlot when you were 21 that you drank with your...
It was a Cabernet Sauvignon.
Oh, it was. It was the most popular wine.
Popular wine in the world.
Yep. Do you remember what that tasted like?
I remember flashes. More so, I don't remember the exact flavor profile, but I remember the texture. And a lot of winemakers actually do less by aromatics and flavors and more on texture, on what the wine tastes like in their palate. So what the start of the wine, what the mid palate of the wine, and what the finish of the wine looks like. And that's why I was so blown away by that particular bottle of wine, was the texture was so different than everything else on the young wines we had been drinking. And I wanted to know, why was that texture so different?
Wow, that's very cool. I wouldn't think of texture when I'm tasting something. I guess for me, it's always been about the flavors, or that's what maybe people talk about more. But I wouldn't have thought the texture. That's really cool. And I mean, how do you get to where you can tell the difference between that? I mean, we just talked about flavors. How can you tell the difference between textures, or knowing textures, what's a good or bad texture?
Textures are actually relatively easy, because it's sweetness, it's sourness, it's saltiness, it's savoriness, it's bitterness. It's these five major components, and how they all fit together. That's the overall texture of the wine. And so there are tools that you can use as a winemaker or a distiller to influence how those textures are perceived. So the big one we've been talking about quite a lot, and that's oxygen. Oxygen is a major contributor to polymerization. Without oxygen, you don't get tannin molecules joining together and precipitating out and smoothing that wine out, preventing that astringency or bitterness that a lot of people associate with red wines. Well, time and oxygen will smooth that wine out. Acidity, again, is a component that you can remove using a couple of different techniques. Oxygen and time in the barrel can help accentuate that. Saltiness, don't get a whole lot of savor of salty with wines or spirits. It's not to say that they can't be there, particularly with higher acid varieties. Something that's done in stainless steel and is very tart could have a saltiness component to it. Sea spray as an aromatic is often associated with higher acid wine varieties. But then savoriness, the amount of time and stirring of lees in white wines and barrels that are fermented in a barrel, that can add to savoriness components. It can help round wines out. The same thing can be done with spirits. The amount of time spirit sits in a barrel can add savoriness, can again smooth those tannins out, that interaction between the charred wood and the high proof alcohol. That time will help mellow those characters out. And so these are all aspects that are texturally, individually influenced, but it's the picture of how they all fit together. That's what we're after.
Yeah, right. The art and the science. John,
yeah,
you've brought it. How can people find out more about you, about Chandhaska?
There she goes. She got it. You just got to keep drinking through the
Even at, yeah.
That's all you have all to right. keep doing.
I'm out.
You can you can find us on the web. We're at Chancasca Wines, plural, that's S plural, .com. My bio is actually on there, so they can find more about me there. They can buy all of our wines are available for purchase through the website. Anybody in the Twin Cities or in Minnesota, we are pretty widely distributed for both wines and spirits. Outstate, we're a little bit harder to find. We do have distribution of our spirits in Iowa, Michigan, Kentucky, Wisconsin. We have our cream liqueurs in about 12 states right now, all pretty much centered kind of on the upper Midwest and the Midwest towards Appalachia. But we're pretty easy to get to. So anybody in Minnesota can pretty find us pretty quick.
Awesome. John, thank you. Let's raise a glass. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun. It's been a lot of fun talking with you and drinking with you.
And learning how oxygen rocks the alcohol world.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. It's been a blast talking with you guys.
You're the man.
Right. Cheers.
Cheers. Go rate and review. We're not blowing hot air, so more people are aware of wellness and business stuff that deserves more oxygen. And subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an exciting episode.
Thanks for listening. But before we go, check out this episode's featured artist, neoclassic country group Leadfoot Larry, with their song, White Lines.
Hey man, could you ever take a wheel just for a little while? It's getting heavy, like my eyes, I need to keep them open wide. My catch a sunrise, Lord, if I do, I'll surely greet the brand new day. It means my lady's just a little further up along the way. So don't cross them white lines. Yeah, I need to get back to my baby to make things alright. So don't cross them white lines. Yeah, I need to get back to my baby to make things alright. Sometimes I wonder if the open road can purify my soul, like finding Jesus in the ties that have conspired to make me roll. My destination is the only thing that keeps me tried and true. So let's find our fortune, and I can tell her, babe, I'm coming home to you. So don't cross them white lines. Yeah, I need to get back to my baby to make things alright. So don't cross them white lines. Yeah, I need to get back to my baby to make things alright. Keep it steady, keep it headed towards that fine horizon line. It's been lying to me. Now I'm ready to embrace the things in life that I was far too blind to see. Don't cross them white lines. Them white lines. Yeah, I need to get back to my baby to make things all right. So don't cross them white lines. Yeah, I need to get back to my baby to make things all right. So don't cross them white lines. Yeah, I need to get back to my baby to make things all right. So that don't cross them white lines. Yeah, I need to get back to my baby to make things all right. So don't cross them white lines. Yeah, I need to get back to my baby to make things all right.